Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to Foment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we co-host this weekly show into all things fermented.
Archived on iTunes and HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
As well as live every Monday night from 7 to 7:30.
Are there things going on, Mary? What's going on?
Yes, there are. We've got two announcements tonight. We'll be brief. The first is that next Tuesday night, November 5th, I'm teaching an alternative fermentations class at Brooklyn Homebrew. There are spots still open. You can just Google Brooklyn Homebrew, look on their class schedule, and check that out if you're interested. We're going to be covering different kinds of fermented sodas, kombucha, including culturing your SCOBY from scratch, short meads, short ciders, all kinds of fun stuff. So if you're interested in alternative fermented beverages, I welcome you to join me in my first class at Brooklyn Homebrew.
And as her cohabitant, I will say it's totally worth doing. I get to reap the benefits of her experimentations to all those regards. It's freaking delicious.
Yep.
But also, we have changed our Choctoberfest to a chocolate and spice fest competition in December. December 7th, we will be hosting a chocolate and spice fest, so there will be, you know, a chocolate portion as well as just any spiced, fermented anything. Check out fermentaboutit.com to find out more information about that.
We'll have that updated later. We have a Facebook page as well. And the basics are we've got three different two different categories and then a series of prizes within. So we have an alcoholic category and a non-alcoholic category. And then you can either enter as a spice beverage or food. It's fermented beverages or food. Anything, if it's been fermented, it's fair game. So alcoholic or non-alcoholic, and then you either enter chocolate or spice. And then we're going to have a People's Choice Award as well.
And the specific chocolate, if you do the chocolate thing, we're in partnership with Divine Chocolate USA, who is a fair trade company. Basically, all the farmers that make the cocoa for Divine Chocolate own part of the company. It's a really cool, and we really support what's going on with that. But that said, the chocolate component award of that will be with that in particular. But if you are on the spice side and you choose to include chocolate, it doesn't necessarily have to be Divine.
But the Divine, so any of you that are interested in entering in the chocolate category, you must use Divine, but it will be provided to you free of charge.
Absolutely. So email me, kuzmi@kuzmi.com or fermentaboutit@gmail.com. But today, what's day about, Mary?
Cider!
She says this. She's knitting right now. I don't know why she's knitting on the air. Like it's.
I like to multitask. So we have two very special people in the studio with us, Joy and Jeremy from Proper Cider.
Joy and Jeremy Hammond.
Hello there.
Hello. Hi.
Thanks for having us.
So we have had a couple cider shows recently. One recently and a couple, you know, throughout the year we've been doing this. We're coming up on our, you know, 1 year anniversary. We like to talk about how easy it is to do at home, and I feel like you guys are doing it so well. And you seriously, and I can say this with absolute honesty, you guys are some of my favorite cider makers in America in what I've tasted. And
oh, come on.
And
I'm sorry.
Am I on the radio? Wait, yes, I am. I absolutely mean that. I love what you guys do. I love the care that you take doing it. I'm really honored that you guys have joined us tonight. And I want to talk about the, you know, we talked about how to make cider. We talked about how simple it is. You get some apples, you get some cider, you get some yeast, and we do it. But you guys take take a lot of care into choosing your apples, into blending. The blending side of it is a thing that takes a lot of attention and detail that you have a strong passion for. And I want to talk about where you guys are from. How the hell did you get here? Why are you doing what you're doing? You're not doing it for money. You guys are doing it because out of sheer passion. And I love it. Hi, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks.
So what was the question?
I know. What was the question? No.
Thank you for the kind compliment.
Well, it's absolutely honest.
It's absolutely true.
I wonder. I just want to throw this out. You tasted it. You liked it. I don't think we're doing things so different than when we started. And every year has been a little bit of an experimentation. And this, like, the ninth year I've made cider, I feel to say, like, I don't know anything about fermentation. The more I'm doing it, and the more I'm studying it, and the more I'm getting into it, the more I realize I don't really know what I'm doing at all.
What I mean
to say is, it seems like everybody's coming to the side of enjoying some interesting flavors. Like, you guys had some Spanish ciders with us the other night, and there's funky flavors and different things. And when we first started doing this, we made those things, and people told us, this is terrible. This is awful. And I would just say, well, actually, this is just what happens when you ferment an apple.
Right.
I don't know that it's terrible. I mean, I could show you Brie or Camembert, which also goes through some weird things. That smells terrible to some, but other people love it.
Delicious.
So, like, throughout Cider Week, we've met some new friends and some amazing cider makers, and we're finding that everybody has their different philosophy and their different way of going about things. And we are starting to just now figure out what our thing is, and it does come back to blending. We're doing all kinds of different experimentation. Anything that any random events that happen in our fermentation, we embrace.
Yeah.
And that's the big difference between doing something at your home and doing something that needs to be sold on the market. We don't really care what people think. So.
Right. Yeah. Like, we embrace diacetyl, which I think is not something people
do. Diacetyl is a butter type
butterscotch
flavor,
compound, right? That's a natural product of fermentation. It can be absorbed depending on the yeast, but, you know, it's acceptable to some degree in all kinds of fermented beverages. Mm. Wait, so I have to set this up, because I met you guys 3 or 4 years ago back when Beer Table was in business. Justin Phillips, I was there for, I think, a tasting or a homebrew night or something. Yep. Justin Phillips came up to me, he's like, Mary, you have to meet this couple. They're making cider in Brooklyn. So I introduced, you know, I met you guys. You're telling me, like, oh, they seem very cool. And then you start talking about the scope of your cider making, and you whip out your phone and you're showing me these, you know, your press, your hydraulic press and your...
Yeah, you're upgraded over the years.
Yes, and now even
more
so.
Quite a weekend, right? Yeah.
So kind of to set this up, I mean, you guys are only, you're home cider makers.
Yep. Yeah.
How much cider are you going to produce? How much did you make this last year, and how much do you plan to produce this year?
Are the feds listening to this radio show? First question.
No, probably not.
So this year we'll probably end up making, like, between 900 and 1,000 wine bottles, 750 milliliter. So, I don't know, quick math. I don't know what that is. It's like nearly 200 gallons, something like that.
170-something, I think we figured.
Yeah, we're not done yet. We got more to go.
So, I mean, you're doing this on a very large scale, and you've been, like you said, you've been making it for 9 years. You are definitely the most serious home cider makers that I've ever come across.
It's because we like making things difficult for ourselves. We started with a Juice Man Jr. and a basket press in a little 300-square-foot apartment.
Right.
And when you started, did you start straight with pressing? Like, did you ever do anything with that, with pre-made or pre-pressed apples?
No.
In 2004.
The very first batch that I got, I bought them from the Prospect Park Market on a Saturday. Yeah. Worked out a deal where I took some of the beat-up apples from a guy for $60, brought them home, and made, like, 2.5 gallons. And
with a Juice Man juicer and a basket press.
Yeah, and the basket press turned into pillowcases and squeezing.
like garbage. Is this cider brew in a bag?
Well, it's like you get the pulp out of the Juice Man, you marry the juice and the pulp together because you want them to hang out together for a little bit. You don't want them separating. You put them in the bag and you squeeze them. And everybody had to wear hair nets back in those days because we cared about tiny details. But if you're brewing or fermenting on a small scale, a small problem can ruin everything. And when people find out how much we're doing, they're like, oh, well, why aren't you selling it? What's the purpose of doing more and more and more? And as you guys probably can explain better than me, if you have a really vigorous fermentation happening, it can actually take over from a bad fermentation. A bad problem that's in there can be negated, to my understanding, with a greater quantity. So if you're making like a little 2.5 gallon batch, it's totally different than trying to make like a 30 gallon or a 50 gallon batch. Right. And we're having more success out of more quantity. So we keep pushing to try to do more.
Right.
Just to experiment and get colors and flavors and
And we like doing things the hard way.
Yeah, there's that too.
This is an interesting note towards last week's cider episode where we had Drew Beecham, and he was like, you know, when he makes cider, he would get juice from anybody and let it kind of naturally ferment for like a day or two or maybe a little bit more, and then inoculate it with a yeast that would trump all the funk from all those other yeasts, kind of kill those other yeasts, and then so you have just enough funk or just enough kind of weird random
flavors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I love vocabulary, Maria. You're awesome. And but then it takes over and kind of quells that because that yeast will trump that.
And if you're going small scale, it's hard to do that.
Right.
I think. And when we were trying to do some blending in the beginning, we made vinegar. Yeah. Like it happened. That was a mistake. That was a flaw we can't embrace. There's apple juice and there's vinegar. Those are the two rules. Those are the two things to avoid. You want something else.
So when you make a cider,
yep.
you guys have gone through a variety of yeasts. Yep. So let's go basic with that. Do you guys have a favorite yeast? Do you guys still do, when you guys do a bunch of different apples, you do a bunch of different yeasts?
I think it just starts with the varieties.
Yeah. So for us, it starts in the field. We start eating and tasting things in the field.
And that's my jam.
If you're a home brewer and you want to do cider, you can definitely buy apple juice. I don't call that cider, the brown stuff. That's apple juice.
Yes, right.
Cider is
that was our lesson very important. From last week. Yeah.
He's like, let's quit this thing. Cider, that's actually a prohibition kind of thing. They wanted to keep calling the old apple juice cider just to kind of get people still thinking about cider or like call it that. But really the meaning is totally different.
Juice, you can juice, buy that.
Cider is alcoholic. Juice is not.
I think all the home fermenters should probably try that. The thing is, you don't know the provenance of that juice. Right. You don't know what it's gone through. I've read things that say that if it's UV treated, you get a buttery something or other. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe they put potassium metabisulfite. You don't know what's happened. Maybe it's been cooked and you get a cloudy result. So I think anybody who's into fermenting things will eventually go buy a gallon jug of that and just see what happens. For us, it starts in the field and we start eating things off of trees and we start to talk about tannin and acid and sugar and then we try to line different field blends up in containers, and we take them home, and we make sure we've got good, sound, clean fruit. And then we start playing with yeast. And we've had not good luck with one yeast that will later do something really amazing. And that's that point where I get where I'm saying we don't really know what we're doing. We're having fun.
Well, I think that's important because we were at that event again together the other day on Saturday with our friend from Farnham Hill, and he was like, I still don't know exactly what's going on. But meanwhile, he's making my favorite commercial cider out there. Steve was still like, I still don't know what I'm doing. We're still learning on the whole process, and I think there are so many variables that go into brewing this beverage in particular that you know, he's like, you know, there are still
random events that happen.
Really best guesses.
It's alive.
There's at times I'm jealous of the beer maker because they're starting almost in a vacuum. As long as your stuff is clean and as long as you've boiled your wort, mm-hmm. you can follow that recipe and you can achieve the notes that are in your yeast. You can actually get those things. We can't do that. We'll read them and go, wow, fruity, floral, star fruit,
citrus and notes, kiwi. And tropical fruit. Yeah, that
wow,
sounds good.
That sounds interesting. And then what you get is like bacon flavor. You're right. Like, right. What happened? Well, we've read. I went online and I found the UC Davis fermentation courses on wine, mm-hmm. and I went through their syllabus and I found the books that they're. I paid like $200 for this really thick book with a lot of math in it. I don't do a lot of math, but I read the book and I'm like, wow, this sounds amazing. If you do this, then you get this, and if you're testing things and test tubes and you're tartriting and checking for available yada yada, and it was really cool. And then I thought that's less exciting to me. We're not dealing with a dead product that's been boiled. Though in the case of the wine, you're dealing in a laboratory, and that's also not what we're doing. So we're finding that sometimes you'll have a yeast do something really cool, and that same yeast will do something not very cool. And in general, a lot of cider makers will just tell you, you want to express the fruit. You want to leave, you want to have a yeast that doesn't do anything too wild to express the appleness of the beverage. I'm kind of the opposite. To me, wine doesn't necessarily taste like grape to me. You don't want grapey wine.
Right.
And I don't want apple-y cider. To me, it's not an apple soda. It's not a hard apple juice. It's not what it is. It does something weird. It does something funky, and it's not just based on the health of that apple or the sugar, but it's based on the temperature when you picked it, how long it sat. As these apples are sitting, they're evaporating. All kinds of things are happening.
Let's talk to that. What is the best ripeness of a fruit or of an apple that you look for? I mean, I know this is personal preference, but in your experience, going to the farm and picking the apple, when do you pick the apple? Do you pick the apple? Do you get off the floor?
Joy tells me not to pick some apples. I'm like, oh, these are great, and they're really easy to get because they're all right here. Let me just get them all. And she's like,
they're not ready yet.
Yeah, they're not ready. But I can back the truck right behind them and just dump them into the truck.
Apples come into season as early as August all the way into like late November, maybe later. I have one apple tree, so I'm not really an orchardist or an apple grower, but technically I am with the one tree.
But if we're eating off the tree, we find something that's just, it just explodes in the mouth. We're like, let's take that. That's cool. That's really sour.
Well, I can tell when the flavors are developed in an apple, and I look for interesting flavors, and that's part of the playing with the yeast, too, to help express those flavors, because I'll bite into something and be like, this is tangerine, or like, this is like a baked apple pie. It's got a butteriness, or... Or yeah, like a cinnamony almost.
You named
flavor,
a tree this year the lemonade tree because it was just you bit it and it was just super
something that
sour.
Tastes like lychee because sometimes we go for wild apples and yeah, you bite into it and usually I hit the sunny side of the apple because it's got like a pink blush depending on the variety. And then the backside that gives me a good indication of whether or not it's I guess done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the other thing that we're looking for is high sugar because. One of the problems in fermentation with cider is it's low alcohol. And so, and we're not doing potassium metabisulfite. We're not sterilizing. We're not killing things. We're embracing things. But if it's low sugar, it's more susceptible to problems. So high sugar is nice. Early season apples, we're getting 5% potential alcohol. Later season, or if you let the apple just sit for a while, sit just as long as it's not rotting, reducing sugar, you can get 9.5.
Yeah.
So that's the range. And up here, you're going to get cool, interesting things. So... It's a balance of sugar and
acid
and
like
tannin.
Acid.
Sometimes you'll eat something and go, this is awful. I want all of those apples. Let's do something with them. Let's see what happens.
This pulls all the moisture out of my mouth.
We have to take a really quick break. But before we do, have you guys ever heard of the Pinkaboo apple?
The Pinkaboo?
The Pinkaboo.
Sounds new.
Oh, my God. It's pretty crazy. Like, so I have a friend that just kind of helped me over at 508 and 508 Gastrobrewery. And he actually just started he got a paid job at 508. He's just helping me out.
He's your intern.
My intern, yes. Little Pete. I love him. Skinny Pete, not Little Pete. Skinny Pete. Anyway, he got a job working at a farmer's market kind of thing, and he has brought back these apples that are called the Pinkaboos, and basically they are green on the outside, like Granny
pink
Smith,
flush.
And then you open them up, and they're like, they have these pink streaks. It's totally crazy. They're
pink
freaking delicious, but we'll talk more about tannins, sweetness, all of that stuff in about a minute.
We'll be back with proper cider shortly.
Stay tuned. About it.
In about a minute or something. I don't know.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back to Foment About It on heritageradionetwork.org. So we're in the studio tonight with Joy and Jeremy from Proper Cider talking about, well, what is Proper Cider? How'd you guys come up with the name?
Yeah, how did we come up with that name?
It's got a good story.
You know, a lot of people would come up and say, oh, there's this cider with, you know, ginger in it or this or that. And we're like, oh, that's not proper.
That's a six-pack cider. Yeah, like, usually a commercial variety cider, to me, is not something that I've been interested in the past.
Right. Yeah.
The things that people are more familiar with. They're sweeter, they taste very apple-y, and sometimes they have ginger and fall flavorings, and that's...
Pumpkin spice.
Yeah, to us, yeah. That's not a real cider or a proper cider.
Do you guys ever sweet back your cider?
Would you consider fermenting in the bottle, adding a bit of sugar to make sure a second fermentation happens in the bottle? Is that back sweetening?
No.
If there's no residual
more priming
left.
Than back sweetening.
I'm going to say
So we do priming. We don't do any back sweetening. Everything is completely dry as it can get based on that yeast. But when we would mention, we make cider, people would say, I don't really like cider. It's too sugary. Oh, well, that's because that's not a proper cider. And then, what do you mean?
It's a conversation starter more than anything, really.
Yeah. It's also a way to sound snide and snooty.
Right.
So you're going upstate into Connecticut and...
Only New York so
only
far.
Only New York State. Okay. So all New York State apples. So you're tasting the apples, you're picking them or you know, purchasing them and bringing them back down. Are you, when you are pressing those apples, are you doing some single varietal and some blends of apples or...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some stuff I'm like, oh, honey, this one tastes crazy. We got to do a single variety of this. Like,
that's me. I'm honey.
Yeah. there's a couple things that we pressed today that I was like, oh, this is crazy tasting. I just want to see what it does by itself.
We have an interesting way of tracking stuff. We'll know when we picked it, how long it sat, just so that we have a record of what happened. Because a year later is when we're really starting to taste this stuff and going, what the heck is this? Where did this come from? Pull out some paperwork and say, oh, yeah, this is the one you nicknamed A or B. And you're trying to keep track of stuff. And then there's a lot of math because you've got to make sure if you're crushing X number of apples, you're going to be able to get it into a 15-gallon demijohn versus a 5 so that you can keep stuff labeled and understand where it's coming from.
So you guys are doing a variety of batch sizes. Are you doing less than 5 gallons?
Well, sometimes...
Just 'cause we have the space, yeah.
Sometimes you can only get a couple apples, so we have a bunch of 3 gallons, and those will get tossed in, like spicing
up. We've got like a couple 3-gallon carboys. We fill everything.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, it makes sense, especially if you come across something that maybe you don't have very many of, but you want to do a single varietal and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. And it helps with blending. The more I can separate something out in the pressing and play with yeast at that point, the more we've got to play with in a blend to get the full mouthfeel.
Real good cider apples are hard to find. So if you can get your hands on some and you want to do them by themselves, it's not going to be 15 gallons. It's going to be like
a cider apple, then, by that definition.
I guess, Joy, you want to stab at that?
Technically, I guess. Well, I don't even know if this is a technical way to say it, but the easier way to say cider apple to me means an apple that really is only for cider. It's practically inedible. Like, you bite it and you're like, get out of my mouth right now. It takes all the moisture out of your mouth, tastes like poison. It's terrible.
There's no other use for it then.
Yeah, one of my favorite apples that I hardly get to work with is called the Major, and makes a really cool pink juice, but tastes terrible out of hand. But it creates a really great mouthful.
The Major is offensive.
Because
would it work alone? Tannins. Probably not. It just has the tannins. It's a good blending thing to balance the sweetness of another apple.
Yeah, it could possibly work alone. I've never played with it alone. It's very, to my palate, it's quite similar to the Kingston Black, which is an apple that a lot of people do single variety cider.
Farnham Hill. Does West County do one too?
I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Well, even the Normandy cider that we're drinking now, we've been to Normandy. We've picked up apples off the ground there, and they're terrible. Like, they make really pleasing beverages, but they're not great to eat. And to me, that's as I spill cider everywhere. that can be a cider apple. Of course, we're using a lot of stuff that is good to eat. I don't know that you would.
I mean, lots
eat
of apples
that much
can be used for cider, but mm-hmm. something I would say is a cider apple would be it's an apple that really you don't want to.
Kind of like have you
like
guys
a crab apple? If anybody out there has ever tasted a crab apple, that's nobody eats crab apples. They're actually used. grown as decorative trees, but those you can make good. You can make cider with crab apples, correct? Totally.
There's a lot of dessert varieties of crab apples too, which are completely edible.
Oh, that's true. I guess. It's
crazy. So by edible, you mean it just personal preference, just not liking all those tannins and bitterness that happen in the apple. Like, there's not a balance.
You're not
there's not a sweetness in there. It's just like so like bitter kind of thing. But you still. So if you were to compare that to brewing beer, like we have control over our bitterness and over our sweetness and all that other things. So. You know, with an apple, if you had an apple that wasn't pleasurable to eat because of all these tannins kind of things, that kind of changes once you ferment the juice.
Something else happens.
And you're getting the alcohol and the sweetness of the apple while also getting the counteracting thing without adding any sort of, in my case, hops or anything to give you that.
Right. I feel like hops bring a front-of-mouth feel, a different type of bitterness than an apple would. Like in an edible apple, to me... the tannins, whether they are hard or soft, bring a more back of your tongue mouthfeel. And kind of when we're blending for a cider, I look for things that, I don't know, dance on the front of my tongue as well as they do the back of my tongue to create a full and complete round, I guess, beverage.
We've had a lot of feedback from people who will drink our cider and say, oh, this one's sweeter than that one. They're trying two different ones that we've made, and I'll tell them there's no sugar. And to my knowledge, the sweetness is also coming from the alcohol, because alcohol inherently, your body registers as some sort of sugar or sweetness. I don't know. We're looking to do things that are ultimately balanced, not too much one way or another. And like I was saying in the beginning, we would do things and people would say, oh, this is wrong. This is terrible. We would enter stuff to contests and they would tell us, oh, this tastes like, you know, you had a sanitation problem.
and we'd say, Brett.
Yeah, we would have Brettanomyces, and you know, we would just try doing things on wild yeast, and we'd say, well, it's not wrong. You might not like it, but
it's not a traditional common, as BJCP, a common cider. It's
and
more akin to probably a Spanish cider or a French cider or a Basque cider or something.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have known that. We just make stuff that we think tastes good.
We just learned this week that...
There are issues with entering competitions. I mean, and not being into... not happily... fitting into a certain category.
Yeah, I kind of don't want to now, but he still does.
But I think that's important. Just make things you like. You know, it is relatively simple to do. Not easy to do, simple to do, but make what you like and experiment with that. But if I were...
And so break the rules when you can.
Break the rules when you can.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So you poured us a barrel-aged cider. So let's talk a little bit about that, because I don't think we've had anyone that's talked about barrel aging. Mm-hmm.
That's called our SOB. Straight out of the barrel.
Standard of procedure?
Straight out of the barrel.
No, sorry.
Okay. The SOB.
Gotcha. And
so I think we could
procedure.
We could sum up a lot of the cider making that we're doing. It's based on winemaking. So that's maybe the difference between us and some other people. We're doing things based on some wine growing or wine making techniques. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that is working with an oak barrel. And the oak barrel... can be difficult to deal with, because if it's not completely topped up at all times, if you've got some reduction in there, you're going to get eventually flour on the top, which is zapping flavor away from it. You're going to get vinegar or something terrible. It needs to stay topped up. So what we do is, if we're making our blends, we'll taste the barrel, and we'll decide, hey, we want 2 gallons of that in the blend, 10%. So we'll pull 2 gallons out, 2 gallons goes right back in. So that's kind of the Spanish Solera method of winemaking, where if something, you're always putting something in there. Rarely have we ever had it empty, because that affects the health of the barrel. And the other thing we've played with is stirring the lees. That's something the French do.
What are lees?
So as you're fermenting, you're getting dead yeast cells and all kinds of other things that I've read about. And those things affect malolactic fermentation, and
can be very important in cider making.
Right. And in Chardonnay making, they'll stick a wand down in there on the end of a drill and stir them up. And we've had interesting success. It makes interesting flavors. And after it settles, we'll pull some of that out, taste it. Let's add that to the mix, but let's make sure always we have it topped up. You can't leave the barrel empty. It's a problem.
Yep.
And because you're basically trying to minimize your oxidation.
Yeah.
And exposure to oxygen. Well, right.
It loses, in a week, it loses about...
I can't talk now.
It loses nearly a liter a week. We've got a couple 10-gallon barrels, and it'll lose a liter a week. So we're always topping it up. It's living in there.
Yeah, I used to want to track apples. Like, okay, honey, which apples? That's you again, yeah. which apples are in this bottle? Like, which one did he use? And if we've put anything from the oak barrel into the final blend, he's like, I have no idea.
Yeah, what's in there? I don't know.
So it's more important that you keep a full than,
And then, keep it. So we kind of stop tracking which apples are in which blend.
There's also two different things you can do with this barrel. We bought this barrel new. It's probably 8 years old by now. Some people will take a whiskey barrel or a rum barrel or something. This was brand new. It was lightly toasted. I had to special order that because nobody orders a lightly toasted barrel. But you can ferment in the barrel, and that's a little dangerous because it could spew out the top, creates a mess. So typically we'll rack off if we're going to do that and then let it continue its fermentation in the oak barrel.
So you go through a primary fermentation and you're...
Then we'll throw it back in the oak, and that's going to throw less slee, and it's going to... It's going to operate differently. And then once we're done with the fermentation, we'll store cider in there too. Like right now we're trying to empty it so we can make room for a secondary. Would it be secondary fermentation after it's gone through?
Yeah.
After the first racking?
Yeah.
So we'll rack stuff into there.
Well,
in our world of beer, we would call that secondary fermentation.
In wine, you would call the secondary...
Not necessarily secondary fermentation, but we're racking it off to the secondary, letting it age.
Yeah, there you go. Kind of in the wine world, the secondary is the... conversion of lactic or malic.
The malolactic, right. Yeah.
So quick question, because we are very limited time. When you're blending, first of all, what do you choose when you're blending? But also, are you concerned at all when you blend about splashing and oxidization when you do that? And if so, to what regard?
We're concerned about it. And that's one of those things, it's a big no-no, no oxygen, no oxygen. And then you learn about micro-oxygenation. You learn about that, and things change. They change for the better sometimes.
We embrace it.
Yeah, we embrace it. We're not obnoxious about it. If we use pumps to get things from here to there because stuff's so heavy. I used to purge the line with CO2 just to make sure there was no air in there. And now we'll taste something and go, I don't know, leave it on the table, try it 5 minutes later and
opens
go,
up.
Wow, that's something.
Just like wine.
And micro-oxygenation is a big part of the Bordeaux world. Like, that's what they're all about. That's how they're making $1,000 a bottle, is by doing these different weird techniques with that. We asked Steve from Farnham Hills about it. He's like, I would never do that. Because you're risking a lot when you do something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a stability issue when you're dealing with that oxidation. Yeah.
Well, and introducing oxygen-favorable bacteria, too.
Yeah. And, it might change the flavor, and it does... When you're dealing with, like, a commercial scale, you're dealing with stability, and there's a deep
consistent
concern
product.
For consistency. Yeah.
But we do oxygenate the fresh juice that comes out of the press. That's something that I learned from the beer making world. You want to make sure the yeast is really healthy. It's got a lot of oxygen. So we do that. In the beginning, we didn't. We were frightened of that.
And then I think the first part of your question had something to do with the actual process of blending.
Yeah.
So we lay everything out, take, you know,
12
samples.
Different containers and test tubes, and we taste them all
because,
by themselves.
Because of the fact that apples come into season at different times of the year, we've got tons of different pressings, on top of the fact that, like, I want things to separate, and then we've got yeast trials, and so then all that stuff gets laid out on the table, and we taste each one, make little notes on how you feel the flavor is, and then from there, I kind of look at my notes, and I'm like, okay, well, and then I kind of work for balance and flavor that is interesting to me, so how much... Maybe a little bit of this one with a little bit of this one, because this one's got high acid but really thin, but this one is a little bit richer. Maybe it's got the diacetyl, which I think is interesting.
In our beginning
layering
years,
layering flavors,
we
really.
Would do that and make 12 different blends.
Yeah.
It was too much. And we would find that the things we really loved and wanted to put in the bottle, something else happens during the bottle conditioning.
Right.
Another thing happens that's completely random. The things that we loved, we hated once we opened up. And the things that we were so-so about were amazing. And so now we've backed it down to like five or six things, some with oak, some without, some with a blend, just to keep us sane.
So five or six kind of end products that go in bottles
or 12, kegs. Not 12, but makes five sense. Or six, because that other fermentation that happens during the carbonation within the bottle, it's more randomness,
right?
Which we embrace, and that's an upside for us. And any other cider maker that we've talked to, they're like, yeah, how's that working out for you? I don't know.
Sometimes we
get a bottle that didn't work. You know, it's like cork taint in the wine world. 10% of the bottles have a problem.
Yeah. Much to my engineer's chagrin, I have one final question, which yeah, looking at you, Joe Galarraga, you're the best. So Mary and I have been sitting on a cider experiment that we got a bunch of fresh juice last year, mm-hmm. and we have been letting it sit on. Life is what happens when you're busy making other plans, mm-hmm. and we have not been able to get our cider off of this yeast. And I don't think, is it worth saving? Is there any hope? Where are we going with this? You know, if I decide that in October I want to make some cider, and then I forget by, you know, March, February, or in this case, till the next October, what do you think?
I think temperature is the first question.
Temperature, how it was stored, light. Light's a problem, just like for beer. But if it's not vinegar, put it in something. Yeah,
we're going to taste it very soon.
Yeah. Maybe we'll invite you over a little tasting. We'll have a blending. Give us some blending 101. Anyway, thank you so much, Joy and Jeremy, yes. for hanging with us here on Foment About It.
Tune in next week. We'll return to beer next week on Foment About It on heritageradionetwork.org.
Foment About It over here. Hey.
Hey. Not for nothing.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.